And then I got on one knee, and then I asked whether you would be my wife. And then, before you had any chance to answer, I think
Audrey ran
Audrey ran
away.
away. She bolted to like up the hill towards like this tree area. And so you said,
Hi, everyone. This is John One, and you're listening to The Same Boat. Welcome aboard.
Hi everyone, my name is Roy Kim, and I'm really glad you can join me for this episode. I've been the host of The Same Boat for the past 4 years, since 2016, and after today, I am passing my hosting and producing duties over to another team who want to keep The Same Boat going. I'm so grateful to them for wanting to continue what I started. They agree with me that broken, authentic humanity needs a voice. You know, essentially, this podcast is a big middle finger to perfectionism and also to the shame that comes with missing the mark. I really want more of us to share our stories of brokenness and humanity. Because that's when we start getting mentally and emotionally healthy. It's been 4 years since I shared with you my personal story in episode one. A lot has happened since that episode. One of the biggest things that happened is that I got remarried in 2018 to a wonderful woman named Jen. In addition, I became a stepdad to a precious girl named Audrey. Ours is a unique story. You won't find too many remarried families out there who are multi-Asian and Christian and with stepchildren, but more special than the rareness of these demographics is the story behind the blending of these three people. I wanted you to get to know a bit about my wife and my daughter, and also about the Lord God who wove us together. I present to you episode 25, Beauty from Ashes. Here's my wife.
Hi everyone, I'm Jen, and I'm really proud of how far Roy's come with this podcast. He started it when we were still dating in 2016, so it kind of feels full circle for me to be able to share our story and my personal journey here.
Mm-hmm. So speaking of how we met in 2016, I think that's a good place for us to start. Like, I'm sure people are wondering, like, how we met. You want to begin to sharing that story? Because I'm sure my perception of things is different than yours.
So we met on Match.com. I had waited 3 years since my own divorce to start dating. But when I did start, I went full force. And I went on every single app and dating site there was. I did eHarmony, Tinder before it was
Tinder
before it was totally sketchy. OkCupid, Coffee
that's,
Meets Bagel.
I know that one because that's a free one.
Coffee Meets Bagel, and I was about to take a break from online dating, but my friend told me about a Groupon for Match.com, and it was about to expire, so I gave it one more chance.
You like bargains.
I sure do.
You love bargains.
And I had actually seen Roy's profile on OkCupid. And I think I had, like, either, I forget, like, hearted him or winked or something, but I got no response.
You make me sound
cold-hearted and cold-blooded.
But when he had messaged me on Match.com, I was a little bit wary because he had not responded to my wink on the other platform.
It's playing hard to... It's called playing hard to get. What did I put on my profile again? You have a better memory than I do.
I think for, like, body type, you would put lean and athletic.
What's wrong with that?
Toned and athletic. Sorry, not lean and athletic, because you are lean.
I believe I'm lean and toned.
It was and athletic.
And athletic. Mm. I play ping pong. Mm-hmm. It takes a lot of athleticism to excel at ping pong. Mm-hmm.
Do you remember my profile picture?
Yeah. You. It was one of the things that grabbed my attention the most. You were next to a llama. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking, I must get to know this person. Mm-hmm.
I think there's a question for smoking, and you said, I'll tell you later. Mm-hmm. Which I thought was very mysterious.
You know, and salmon and smoked hams and...
I had no clue that Roy used to be a pastor. It just had therapist on there, which I actually really liked since I had my own personal experience going to therapy for several years.
And I think that's one of the things that, like, when I found out that you had gone through your own therapy, that was I dig how people advocate for their own health like that. So if you had gone through a horrible, horrible event, you know, such as the divorce and everything, and then not gone through any sort of therapy for yourself, like, I think that would have been a
red flag
for me, you know.
Yeah, so our first date, we had only talked online for not too long, maybe a couple weeks before we met in person. And we met at a cafe in Fullerton, and it was very comfortable. Conversation was very easy and light and funny. We did realize we had a lot of similarities. We both had graduated from the same college.
Go Bears.
I found out we both used to own an old Avalon. Toyota Avalon was my first car, and he had one as well. I don't know. It was just very comfortable and fun.
I know. You were pretty self-conscious that you had a cough that day.
Yeah, I actually had a cough drop in my mouth the whole time because I was getting over a cold. But I felt like if I didn't go on this date, it would have been like our schedules wouldn't have aligned otherwise.
No. If you had not gone this date, then you would have missed out on the opportunity of a lifetime. So
right. So I had a cough drop, and I remember on my way there, I was like the whole time thinking or just praying that he wouldn't think I was like desperate, still sick and going on this date. And turns out he didn't even realize I had a cough drop.
It goes without saying that it takes more than similarities, such as same college, and same beat-up car, the same divorced status. You can probably come up with your own bizarre coincidences to warrant a committed relationship. We gravitated towards each other because of our interactions, which came from a standpoint of health after a long time of healing. And then we became official, exclusive.
But what was... funny for me was when we had the DTR talk, defining the relationship, I wasn't sure what our status was because he hadn't asked me to be his girlfriend or told me that he was going to be my boyfriend.
That's so fifth grade. Like, that's...
he had just said, we should stop seeing other people.
Yes, I think that's way more to the point.
And so when I went home, I was like, is he my boyfriend or is he just a special friend? So we have this whole inside joke of him not being very clear and me being confused for several days, and I had to consult with different girlfriends.
Okay, listeners, you be the judge. If you think that saying I'd like for us to be exclusive is the right way to say it, post a comment on the Same Boat Facebook page saying Roy is right. And if you think saying, will you be my boyfriend or girlfriend is the right way of saying it, write a review on your podcast platform and say, Roy is right. After 6 months of dating exclusively, Jen thought it would be appropriate for me to meet Audrey. And then we became kind of a trio after we met her, because you had to kind of make excuses to Audrey, like who you're going to go see at nighttime.
It was a really big relief for me because, you know, even prior to you, every time I had gone out on a date, I would have to tell her, oh, I'm meeting with this girlfriend or, you know, that girlfriend. So she didn't really know who I was meeting.
Well, and she was six at the time.
Yeah, and I felt a lot of guilt, you know, leaving her at home with my parents on a Saturday night.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
It was a big relief that we could all three spend time together.
Before we get too far ahead in the story, I want to guide you back in time to Jen's backstory. Her first marriage that looked great on paper turned out to be utterly traumatic. Infidelity was just the tip of the iceberg. She only told me a handful of horrific stories, and I know that there were many more. I asked her if she would share more about her backstory.
All my life, I've always been a rule follower, and I was a very obedient child. Never got in trouble with my parents, and you know, I was a good student. I went to a good school. You know, I had never really dated anyone prior to my first boyfriend, who I ended up marrying, and life seemed pretty good. He graduated from med school as a surgeon. He was 6 feet tall. He was Christian, and he spoke Chinese to my parents. So everything seemed to
check all the boxes.
Exactly. He checked off all the boxes. But the reality of things behind closed doors was very different. There was a lot of emotional, verbal, financial abuse. My life was a living nightmare. And I was so ashamed, you know, all the lies that my ex had told me of me being boring when I became a mom, or, you know, that I wasn't attractive. You know, I just had very low confidence, and I believed all these lies about myself. And I also contributed to a lot of unhealth in my marriage, so it wasn't completely one-sided, but there was a lot of abuse. I really lost a sense of who I was. He had made a lot of demands of me that at the time I thought were reasonable. For example, he would constantly tell me that unless I became the perfect wife for him, he would not change his behavior to become the perfect husband. Which I knew in my heart was wrong, but I remember writing in my journal, okay, I can meet these demands, so I will change first.
So those were the words, like, you have to be the perfect wife.
Literally, word for word.
Wow.
Gosh, there were so many crazy-making things he would say. Love is a feeling. I don't have those feelings for you anymore, so therefore, I want to leave this marriage because it's no longer fun or exciting. I just don't have those butterfly feelings, and I want those butterflies back again.
Wow.
How many women would die to be married to me? And in my mind, I was thinking, are you kidding me? But he was dead serious. And just, you know, these are just three examples out of dozens and dozens of crazy words.
Did you see signs of that when you were dating?
I did. Not to the extent of, like, you know, him calling a mother effer. Like, you know, I was never cussed at when we were dating.
Uh-huh.
But there were red flags of his personality and his character that I conveniently overlooked.
Mm. So why? Like,
I think part of me felt like, oh, I'm not going to find anybody better than this.
Mm.
And I had not dated.
Who else can check all these boxes?
Right. And I hadn't, you know, really had serious relationships. So I had this preconceived notion, like, you date for marriage, and he does meet all the criteria. So yeah, and he likes me too. And so if he proposes, yeah, I'm going to get married to this guy.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So was there the assumption that things would just kind of resolve themselves?
Totally. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Once he's done with residency or once he's done with this rotation on trauma surgery, things are going to get better. Once he gets more sleep, you know, once I have more time, once I'm not commuting to my job, Yeah, there's always that projecting into the future.
Yeah. Your experience of marriage was nightmarish.
It was hell. Yeah. And it was awful because no one knew the abuse that was going on at home.
Why is that? Like, why didn't you share that with people?
I was so ashamed. You know, I'm very close to my parents, but I couldn't tell them because I was afraid that people wouldn't believe me. I didn't tell my sister. I didn't tell my closest girlfriends. And I wanted to preserve the image that I had it all. You know, I didn't want to tell people of the different names he was calling me or me witnessing him flirt with other women. It was just, I was too broken and too embarrassed until I couldn't take it anymore. And then it all came out.
Yeah. No, I get that. When I found out about what my ex had done, the year of betrayal behind my back, it took me a while before I could tell my parents too. I just felt this need to keep that within. It probably was shame and maybe the fear of how they would react. Mm-hmm. Like as we're even just like talking about it right now, and I know your story and just you saying it out loud again, it makes me think about people who are listening right now. They're going through hell right now, and they're not telling anyone. Mm. Like, you know, you remember what that felt like,
right? It's a very lonely place.
It's a horrible place. Mm-hmm. Are you glad that you told your parents or your friends?
I just wish I had told one person sooner. Mm. Yeah.
Well, what did that feel like when you finally did?
I felt relief because everybody I told 100% believed me. I mean, they wish it weren't true. And I remember just how worried my parents were. And that's when my parents, being the Chinese parents they are, it's surprising that they were the ones that convinced me to go to therapy. You know?
Yeah.
Whereas most Asian parents associate therapy or mental wellness, like there's taboo about it.
With like you being crazy.
Right. But I'm so thankful that it was my parents that gave me the number of a therapist. I was crying just every day. I lost so much weight. I couldn't eat. And I held on to that number, the therapist number, for a good 2 weeks, even though I was desperate. I didn't know what to expect in therapy. It was so foreign to me, but it took me 2 weeks to finally, you know, to have the courage to tell somebody, hey, I need help. Like, I am just dying inside.
I really hope that Jen's story doesn't go wasted. She gives this story to help you feel that you're not the only one, but also to motivate you to make extremely difficult but necessary choices. Things like getting professional help, or finding support, or creating boundaries around character issues. Jen's therapist asked her if her husband owned a gun. She felt that his volatility should be taken seriously and that she should be ready to go at a moment's notice when she felt endangered. Jen exercised an ultimate boundary by fleeing the marriage.
Things in my marriage were escalating. And, you know, when I had left the marriage, Audrey had barely turned one and I wasn't working. I lived about an hour away from my parents' house. And because my ex worked a lot of hours, he was at work and he had changed all the bank accounts password on me. And so the night before I realized, wow, like I'm really like sleeping with the enemy. Just after a series of events, I made up in my mind, like I'm going to leave tomorrow morning. And that morning was January 1st, 2011. Mm. Because Audrey was young, I just took a duffel bag of her clothing, a few toys, a few baby bottles, and I felt like I was leaving a burning house. I literally took one duffel bag with me, and I had to make sure I left, you know, while he was still away. And I remember driving, I had this...
Your heart must have been pounding.
It was. I was shaking, and I had a van, a minivan at the time, which I hated driving a minivan. I remember I was listening to the sermon, and it was all about Joseph and suffering. I cried the entire car, you know, the entire 40 miles home because I had made up in my mind that I could not be married to this abuser and mentally unwell person anymore.
I remember your dad mm-hmm. telling you mm-hmm. What to do, you know, like about your marriage.
So, you know, a lot of Asian parents would be so ecstatic that their daughter marries a doctor and mm-hmm. they must remain married at whatever cost.
It'd be considered crazy to leave a marriage.
Right, especially since he was about to finish his residency and just make a lot of money.
Yeah.
But I am so thankful for my parents because I remember my dad, when he realized the extent of the abuse, he had told me, run. Don't just walk away from this marriage. You got to run and leave this person as fast as you can. And that's not something Asian parents say to their children. But no. I'm so thankful that they saw the truth of what I was telling them. And they encouraged me to, you know, start over again.
Yeah. I mean, it begs the question, how much does sanity cost, right? How much does safety cost? Mm-hmm. If a surgeon makes 300 grand, if he makes 500 grand, mm-hmm. half a million a year, would we be willing to pay 500 grand per year for sanity?
And, you know, that's a good point because I remember our legal battle was totally not in my favor because it was a short-term marriage. So I didn't really get spousal support. Mm-hmm. Child support was also minimal because of our living standard at the time was based on his resident salary. We had to sell our house below cost because we were in a rush to get rid of it. I wasn't working. I had at most $4,000 in my bank account when I moved home as a 28-year-old to my parents' home. It was humiliating. My friends were, gosh, they probably, some weren't even married yet, and I was already divorced with a baby.
Yeah.
Moving back to my parents' home when my married friends were buying their own homes.
Yeah.
And, you know, I even remember my mom, like, quantifying it. She was like, okay, fine. Say you got X amount of dollars. Like, is it worth losing your life? And I remember thinking, no amount of money is worth me losing my identity and my feeling of self-worth and confidence.
Yeah. I love your mom. How much is your safety and sanity worth? God showed that you are worth the cost of His only Son. If you downplay your worth, there is a huge disconnect between how you view things and how God views things. One of my mentors, Dan Drake, told me the analogy of getting badly rear-ended by a car, which is traumatic enough. But then you have to go through a different phase of pain, which is the painful physical therapy, or even the reckoning that your body won't be able to be exactly the same as it was before. Jen shares about the rehab and the reckoning.
It was hard for me to say that I was a single mom.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I really felt like damaged goods. Who was I ever gonna date again when I had a child in tow? I mean, I wasn't even thinking about dating at that point. You know, I remember going to dentists and doctor's offices, and for all their intake forms, they would ask you for your marital status, single, married, or divorced. And I remember just feeling so angry. Like, why does a doctor's office need to know my marital status? And I remember just, like, being angry. I didn't fit in with any friends. I felt very self-conscious to be with my married friends. Even at kids' birthday parties, I would really have to psych myself out, you know, before I went to a party because I knew I would be seeing a lot of couples.
Yeah, I remember how weird it felt for me to say to people that I was divorced.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Even just the word, like, there was this certain
negative energy
that I felt when I said that word.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't believe that it was escaping my own mouth, that described me.
I mean, similarly, like, I never thought I'd have to say, oh yeah, I'm a single mom.
Yeah.
So interesting that you mention how negative the word divorce seem. So just really through God's arrangement, I met a group of wonderful female friends that are all around my age, some who had kids and some who do not. And we all hated that term, divorced, and we hated saying that about ourselves. So one of my friends actually labeled our group of like five or six girls the Sassies, and it's an acronym for single again and super sexy and young. So if you don't want to say you're divorced, you could always say you're single again.
You know, when you said that you felt behind at 28, I was, I want to say around 35. My friends, they were already well into their careers. Mm-hmm. I had just stopped being a pastor. I was making like, what, $5,000 a year as a pastor at a Korean church. And then I was now in grad school accruing more debt. And then I wouldn't be making really any money for the next 3 years as an intern. I felt so behind financially, vocationally, now just, you know, maritally, I felt so behind. And I remember thinking, who is going to marry a divorced man, right? It's a real sinking feeling. Mm-hmm. And I thought, for all intents and purposes, I thought my life was over.
Me too.
I was not in any way suicidal, but I felt like there was nothing really to look forward to anymore. I just kind of braced myself for a pretty awful existence for the rest of my life.
Same.
Do you feel behind too? Pastors, is your church congregation not big enough? Couples, is your home not big enough? Singles, do you feel behind because you're not married yet? If you feel behind, I want you to try to imagine in your mind's eye who is agreeing with you as you say, "I am behind." Could it be your parents that you imagine? How about this? How about Satan? Is he smiling and nodding as you say, "I'm behind"? And what about God? What's on God's face as you tell him you're behind? I think whoever is agreeing with you is the one that is motivating you. How did things turn around for you?
I was hurting so much that I felt like I couldn't just sit at home and do nothing. Like, so I was very intentional with getting help because I was desperate. You know, I did continue seeing my therapist, who I had started seeing secretly at the end of my marriage. And I went to therapy consistently for 2 years.
When you say secretly, like secretly from...
Oh, from my ex, because he didn't believe in therapy. So I knew if he found out, he would either put an end to it or, you know, just be upset with me for airing our dirty laundry.
Because you were using community funds, right?
Oh, so my parents were very generous. They actually paid for my entire therapy.
They did? Oh my gosh. They paid for awesome.
You know, I wasn't working. I had no money coming in because he had changed the password to our joint
account. The accounts, right.
Yeah. I had this 1-year-old and I wasn't working. So,
yeah.
Yeah, my parents, it was a gift. They were like, "Don't worry about the cost. We will pay for you." So they were, they paid for it. So wow. He didn't see anything. Wow. He didn't know.
Wow.
I also found out about the support group called Divorce Care. It was really a godsend of how I happened to come across the support group. I think it was a 10-week program. There's a guided workbook and it's a video series. But I remember the week or the day before I was going to go to this group at a random church in La Habra, I remember telling my mom, like, "I bet there's not going to be Asian people there. There's not going to be anybody, you know, my age." And my mom just told me, "It doesn't matter. Just go. Like, just go check it out. You have nothing to lose." And I remember when I showed up, I was thinking, oh my gosh, I'm right. Like, everybody is so old, you know, like there are non-Asians here. But I remember as we shared our pain, I felt like they really understood me better than my friends could at that time. They encourage you to go through divorce care multiple times because you'll learn different things about yourself each time. And so I actually went through divorce care twice as a participant. And then I cycled through again the third time, but as a like a small group facilitator.
What I like about what you said and how your mom encouraged you is that you didn't limit yourself of like how you would want to get help. Like you were willing to get help even if it goes beyond like cultural norms for you. And I think that's where a lot of people get stuck, is that because they're not really willing to think outside the box, it's just too foreign for them. They miss out on this amazing just human experience, right? Of being connected with people who have similar pain as you. Because, you know, Asians traditionally don't really share that kind of pain. So if you're going to say, screw it, I'm gonna find this level of burden sharing with people outside my culture, let that be the case, right? I'm so glad that you did, you know? Like if,
If you just
stuck within that traditional, let's say, ABC bubble, then who knows how much longer it would have taken you to get healing.
That's one of the valuable lessons I learned from my divorce. You know, because I was hurting so much, I didn't care what kind of I was already in so much discomfort. What's one more discomfort if it can mean getting me help?
Yeah.
And so going to a new mega church, you know, I had always attended Asian American churches. Going to a mega church where that was predominantly non-Asian at the time was also scary. I didn't know one single person at EV Free. And, you know, God just intentionally sent so many friends my way. And older mentors who had walked down this road before me, you know, in my Sunday school class. I just felt so safe.
And I think, you know, traditionally, you know, Asians are a very, like, silent type, maybe unless they're angry. They're silent when it comes to empathy and encouragement and things like that. But I think, you know, you surrounded yourself with people who more naturally are able to speak very uncomfortable things, such as shameful things, embarrassing things. They don't get weirded out by, you know, awkward feelings like many Asians do.
And something else, every time I went on Facebook, I just felt envy, nothing but envy and jealousy, just scrolling through and looking at my married friends'
I couldn't handle social media during that time. It was too much.
I mean, I would see so-and-so eating at this fancy restaurant with their, you know, date or husband. I would see them vacationing at this place with their children. And it was just, it was too much for me. And I decided to altogether deactivate my social media accounts. And it was such a good decision. I don't regret it. I was kind of out of the loop, but it was totally fine. I could focus on the here and now without needing to compare from based on the visuals I was feeding my mind with.
Yeah, yeah. Because you were already feeling like bad about yourself
and, behind,
and your situation.
You know, it just reinforced that.
Exactly.
You don't have this car. You don't have this husband or this whatever it was, you know.
Again, it's just another example, I think, of what the power of wise choices is. Some people don't think to deactivate accounts like that. They just kind of...
And some people aren't as affected by it.
Exactly,
so it just really depends on the individual. But I know for me, I couldn't handle it.
Yeah, yeah. What kind of effect cumulatively did all these have on you? Just as you were trying to recover and everything.
You know, I really started to gain confidence in myself. And I felt like I was being transformed, and I was slowly seeing hope and looking forward to what the next day would bring. You know, I started working full time. I started going on dates and just...
With who?
so much of my dating approach changed, you know, whereas before I was married, I used to think, you got to marry, you know, if you're dating that person, it means you're going to get married. And I think spiritually, it was the time I felt the closest to God. He felt just so, it was so palpable, like my relationship with God. And I miss those days of feeling really grounded. Mm. And can I share some of my funny stories? Not funny, but just of how God met me in ways that were significant to me.
All right, sure. Like,
maybe not significant to anybody else. But it would just reinforce that, you know, God is close to the brokenhearted. Mm. So when I had moved home, I didn't have any space there. I didn't even have a room in my parents' house, even though they have a big house. And I remember one night my mom was cleaning through, her closet, trying to make just to purge. And she excitedly came into my room and was like, oh, hey, guess what? I found your birth certificate. And I was thinking, I've never seen my birth certificate, you know, and I thought that was neat. And I remember, like, as she was giving it to me, I was like, ooh, there's going to be like something special, because God had just been speaking to me through numbers, like different random numbers, not the book of numbers, but like,
nice,
like random digits. Right. And so I was holding this piece of like very nondescript paper. You know, I remember looking at, the time that I was born, the date that I was born, how old my parents were, nothing. Mm. And in the lower left corner, there was like this embossed stamp of when they like processed the birth certificate. And I remember seeing on it, it said December 14, 1981. Mm. And December 14, like my jaw dropped, because that's Audrey's birthday. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. I remember her birthday being stamped onto my birth certificate.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, seriously, I think my heart stopped beating because it was just, you know, God telling me. And I used to think like, oh, maybe if I didn't have a kid so young, like maybe this divorce wouldn't have happened,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
It was just God reinforcing for me that even before I was created, like, he knew my name, he knew Audrey's name, and he knew how things would turn out. But yet, you know, it was all, it didn't surprise God. And and Audrey was meant to be my daughter. And so I laminated that certificate and I hung it up like on my wall, just as a reminder, as a visible reminder of God's care and how detailed he is. And I remember, like, I have so many of these stories that I journaled of just little nuggets that, like, God laid out just for me.
I like that story.
And I have one more story that I want to tell.
Okay.
And I remember I had gone to Disneyland with Audrey. It was just me and her. And it was the first time I had taken her by myself. But I had met up with a friend and her husband and their kids at Disneyland. And I remember the whole night I was I was jealous of, I would just notice how other husbands would treat their wives and how just kind and tender the husbands would speak to their wives. And just really feeling like, you know, I'm not that bad of a person. I'm nice too. How come like nobody speaks to me like that? And I remember just watching their family interact and feeling really just down about myself. And by the time we had left the park, Audrey had fallen asleep on the car. You know, it had been a long day. And I just started sobbing. Like, I was driving home from Anaheim at night back to my parents' house and just kind of crying out like, God, like, I remember just, like, this childish brat, like, what about me? I remember asking God, what about me? Like, how come you forgot about me? Like, where's my husband? Who's going to speak in that way for me? Who's going to go get a jacket from the car for me when I forgot a jacket? Because I had seen my husband my friend's husband do that for her. Mm. And I remember just thinking, it's not fair, God. And I was just whining. It's not fair. What about me? Just repeating it. Don't you, like, care about me? Mm-hmm. And I kid you not, like, at that moment, so I had the Christian radio station on, and it was a song by Mandisa, I think that's her name, it says, like, he knows your name, like, I don't need my name in lights, like, he knows your name, and it just kept on echoing, he knows your name. And at that same moment, the car in front of me had a license plate that had my last name, HSU, at that very same moment. And I would just think, and I stopped crying. I was like, oh my gosh, God, like, you know my name. And you know I'm down here, like, yelling at you, complaining, like, what about me, you know? And I just felt like there were so many stories like that where I just, you know, it wasn't because I was reading my Bible nonstop or praying nonstop, but I was desperate. And I remember just God meeting me so many times, like daily. That would happen to me daily, weekly, you know, during that season. Mm.
God renewed her strength, which helped her battle her internal world. And then came a much stronger test, a real live test, confronting her ex face to face.
Every time my ex would come over to pick up Audrey, I would hide upstairs and peek through the shutters because I was terrified of him. And I had never faced him in person. My parents did all of the handoff of Audrey for me. Whenever I saw his car approaching, like, I would just feel my heart kind of stop. I knew I couldn't out-talk him. I couldn't, you know, I just wasn't as clever with my comebacks or clever with my logic or quick on my feet as he was. I didn't want to feel cornered. And so I would hide, like, literally, I would run up the stairs. My parents would say, okay, he's coming. Mm-hmm. And I would, like, run as fast as I could upstairs. There was an incident where my sister was there, excuse me, and she had said, you need to come down right away. And there was a lot of drama. And I remember thinking, you know what? It's been a year. And he was doing something that was very hurtful to my family. So I had to confront him, you know. And in that split second, I remember opening up the door wide and asking him if we could go outside to talk. And this had been a full year before we had seen each other face to face. I just let him have it. I mean, I didn't cuss at him, but I did tell him that leaving that marriage was the best decision I did for myself. It felt surreal to be able to verbalize my anger as well as exactly how mistreated I had felt by him. And I remember my sister told me, she was either watching or listening from a distance, and she said, wow, you are like a lion. She was like, I felt like that strength and that power. And I just, yeah, I really like that. I think she called me a lion or a lioness. And I think all of the therapy and the healing and the support and encouragement I had from my family and from my friends just really strengthened me not to be afraid of who I was and not to be afraid of him. I mean, this wasn't the final and last time we ever interacted, but it was the beginning of me being brave and standing up to him.
She had another story regarding her ex, or more specifically about a court experience that she thought would give a vivid glimpse into her divorce experience.
Even after my divorce was finalized, my ex brought me back to court to reduce child support amount. The LA courts, or any court for that matter, is super intimidating. Just hallway upon hallway of fluorescent lighting. There's just this hustle and bustle, but it's very eerie. And I remember going to the court in downtown LA, and we were outside. My dad had gone with me for moral support. My ex was there too. We both had our attorneys. I liken it to a reverse wedding because he and I were both wearing the same outfit, which never happens. But we were both wearing like denim tops, blue denim tops and white pants. And I was like, whoa, we're matching. We've never matched. We had to both walk down the aisle to be seated in front of the presiding judge.
Oh man.
We had our two attorneys in between, sandwiched in between us. And so I was thinking, huh, it kind of reminds me of, they're like the bridal party. We're standing before the judge who's like the officiant. Mm-hmm. I had written down all these Bible verses in front of me just to remind me of God's presence with me. Mm-hmm. And I remember when the judge was talking, I was so scared because the stranger was going to determine my fate. Like, not my fate, but how much money I would get for child support.
Mm-hmm.
And he kept on referring to Audrey as the child.
Mm.
And it felt so impersonal and cold. I remember just trembling and shaking when I had to answer questions. And I kept thinking, gosh, this man who knows nothing about my life and what I've gone through is going to determine so much. And at that moment, it dawned on me that, you know, one day we're going to stand before a Heavenly Father and he's going to know everything about
mm-hmm.
me.
Mm-hmm.
Every single tear that I shed, every wrong that happened to me, every wrong that I committed. I just felt peace in knowing that even though this imperfect judge can determine so much, you know, God, the perfect judge, will determine even more. So, I mean, I felt comforted in knowing that, and I've never stood so or sat so close in front of a judge, you know, and they're sitting in their robe and they're high up. So it was a very powerful imagery for me.
Mm. Over time, Jen found enough healing to re-enter the dating world. And that's where she met me. Are you ready to hear a bit more about our dating experience? Yeah, I thought you would. Re-entering this dating world was crazy for me. Like, I cannot believe I'm back in this, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think especially when it comes to entering into the online dating world, because there are, like, filters
mm-hmm.
that you have to provide the data for your own profile, but then mm-hmm. you're also filtering out who's going to appear in your results based upon your filters, mm-hmm. right? So, you know, you start with, like, let's say an age range, maybe you prefer, you know, you filter out which religion, you might filter out, you know, preferred race, ethnicity, background. And then, you know, there's things like divorced,
mm-hmm.
right? Or whether they have children or not.
Mm-hmm.
I remember not thinking in the beginning that mm-hmm. I would ever date or marry someone who has a kid.
Mm-hmm.
Not that I really had any legit reasoning. It's just, it didn't seem like that was something that I would do.
Mm-hmm.
I think I got to a point, though, where I was realizing that the people that I was like idealizing in my mind as the person for me was not really available.
Mm-hmm.
If you think about it, like someone who had never ever been married, who was the right blend of this and that, and as you go down through all those search parameters, like no one pops up on mm-hmm. the results. So as I extended it out to someone who's divorced, someone who has children, there's like many more people who pop up.
Mm-hmm.
And when I saw the picture of you and Audrey, I think you had a unicorn hat on, and she was like a princess.
Headband.
And uh-huh. she was like, I think she was a princess,
yeah,
something like that.
Aurora.
And then you gave a little like caption under uh-huh. the, I think it was for like Halloween maybe.
Yeah.
And you're saying like a princess and her unicorn.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, oh, that's too awesome. And it's little moments like that that started to thaw away,
mm-hmm.
I think, my expectations of myself, like what would be the ideal future
mm-hmm.
for me.
Mm-hmm.
And I started to think like, oh, wow, maybe I can date someone
mm-hmm.
who has a kid. But, you know, it was intimidating
mm-hmm.
thinking that, what, me? A stepdad? I don't know about that, right? I was thinking about that, and that was preventing me from reaching out. You know, I think when we start talking about getting to know Audrey and what our relationship is like right now, I'm thinking, I'm so grateful that I didn't limit myself
mm-hmm.
to
mm-hmm.
those original search parameters, because my life has been, like, revolutionized
mm-hmm.
Because I can now have Audrey as a daughter, you know, and you as my wife. So it's a constant learning process,
mm-hmm.
I think. What was your dating experience like?
I was very upfront in all my online dating profiles that I was divorced, and obviously I included pictures of my daughter and I. I didn't want it to be a surprise. And I really changed my mindset about dating. I read this book by Henry Cloud, How to Get a Date Worth Keeping. I can't remember who told me about it, but it just changed my mindset, you know. I wasn't going to marry the first person I went on a date with, but every person I did go out with deserved to be treated with respect and kindness, even if, you know, we didn't end up together. I learned how to have fun, and I dated for the sake of dating, not just I'm on the hunt for a husband. And I think that made all the difference. I wasn't desperate, and it shows when you're not desperate, and it makes you more attractive. I was very protective of Audrey. Other people had asked to see Audrey. Yeah, multiple people had asked, and I had always said no. I really wanted to protect Audrey's heart in case she got attached early. So I encourage people who are dating for the first time after divorce or, you know, pre-marriage, to really take their time figuring out what they like in a partner and what they're like when they're dating. You know, yes, you want to be married, but if that's your only goal and you're not enjoying the process, like, you're missing out on a lot.
I remember one of the things that I felt back then, and it's even more reinforced now. I think because you and I talked a lot about our therapy experiences, and because you did take your time and you had good friends to consult with and you had mentors, you were in a really healthy place, you know, as you approached dating. Because you were in a healthy place, I didn't feel the need to rescue you. And I didn't feel sorry for you. I could just enjoy the healthy you. Right? I mean, your situation was... it's tough, right? Being a single mom is tough. But it's even worse if I feel that I need to be your rescuer. And you mentioned that you were dating to meet people, to have fun, maybe with the potential of marriage, but that's not your desperate, like, desire. Right. I think I would have been in a lot of just internal trouble if I were thinking, oh no, this poor woman, you know, she's all by herself and she's got this daughter. Oh, maybe I can come and spare her and share the burden, you know, with her, right? And then it all just becomes about helping you.
Right. And we are, and then we wouldn't be equals or partners, right?
Yeah, yeah, right. And I think on the flip side, like, because you went through your own therapy and you knew yourself and you were able to take certain stands and create certain boundaries for yourself, like, that brought out the strength in you that I think is important in any relationship, where two strong people, not thick-headed people, but two people with strength can become partners in a relationship. And it becomes more and more like an interdependency than it is a codependency. Right. So I do remember having those thoughts about you. That was very appealing to me, that we could be on that level of partnership, you know?
I think something that, you know, we found out quickly was that in both of our first marriages, we were idolizing our spouses. And, you know, what was attractive about dating was we had lives outside of each other, right? We had our friends, our families, our work, and we didn't have to idolize each other. Like, you weren't my you were important to me, but you weren't my everything. And I think that's where...
How dare you?
That's... I think if somebody tells you that they're your, you know, you're their everything, you better run in the opposite direction.
But that's what all the love songs are about.
Right? And I think that's super misleading. And that's how I was like when I was married for the first time. I really did idolize him. And I think you shared similarly. And it's scary if somebody's obsessing or that's all they can think about is this one lover. Because when that lover disappoints or fails them, then their world crumbles.
Have you guys heard about the term codependency? If you haven't, I highly recommend that you learn more about it and then evaluate if you are in a codependent relationship. Being in a codependent relationship is going to suck the life out of your soul. If you instead want a healthy relationship, you can learn more about codependency by reading great books out there like Boundaries or Codependent No More. Have I mentioned how much I love being Audrey's stepdad? You know, in some ways, I have a hard time remembering what life was like without her in my life. I don't know how to compare this feeling to having a daughter naturally born to me, but I don't feel like I'm missing out on much. And that's not a minimizing of the wonder that parents feel of being a parent. It's really more an expression of my own love for Audrey. So let's talk about how it all began.
The first time you really got to know her was when we drove down to San Diego.
Well, if I remember correctly, that was like actually the second time that I met her, right?
Yeah, well, the first time she didn't really know who you were because it was at my friend's like backyard barbecue.
Yeah, we didn't interact at all.
Yeah, hardly. She didn't give you time of day.
No, right. She was playing hard to get.
Yeah.
I mean, and she didn't know that we were dating or anything.
Yeah, I just said you were my friend, and she said, okay.
Yeah. And then
And we did that so she would feel comfortable. Like, it wouldn't be just, you know, the three of us. It was more initial exposure.
So we planned, I mean, Audrey really liked Legos or Legoland, right? Mm-hmm. And she liked especially the Best Friends Forever. Mm-hmm. So I was planning on giving her this Lego sticker book. Mm-hmm. I was in the front seat with you. You were driving. And then I said, you know, Jen, I have this Lego sticker book and I've been trying to like figure out who to give it to because I don't want to hold on to it anymore. But for the life of me, I just can't, I can't think of anyone who would want this. And, you know, out of the corner of my eye, I was kind of looking for Audrey's reaction. And then in her little sly, sheepish way, she in the back seat on her booster seat, she's like, I'll take it. I was like, really, Audrey, you'll take it? Uh-huh. Oh, thank you so much. Oh my goodness. I've been waiting so long to give this to the right person. Mm-hmm. It's like, you're welcome. I gave it to her. And she ended up, looking through the entire sticker book the entire time. And I think that was a good icebreaker for us, along with other like funny things we were doing along the way on the drive down.
But while we were at the park, she had mixed feelings about seeing us hold hands for the first time. I mean, she had never seen me hold a guy's hand. And when she saw Roy hold my hand, she immediately became very possessive and came between us, like swatted his hand away and held my hand instead. So
that's all right.
Yeah, I felt sad for her and kind of just torn.
That was a really good trip. And then I think we developed a bond mostly based upon silliness. And I enjoy being silly with her. And then later on, it kind of branched out into other things that we enjoy. I've converted her to Star Wars. I've converted her to Harry Potter. I really enjoyed all these little silly moments with her. What did you observe when you saw me and her together? Because you probably had no idea how she and I would click, right?
Yeah. Audrey's very shy initially when she doesn't know somebody, and it takes a lot for her to warm up. But she was very, you guys were very natural to each other, or with each other. And I remember when you played that video game with the animal.
Yeah, it reads your emotions, and then you become like this animal that does those different missions.
And seeing that, it was very heartwarming for me to see you guys interact so naturally and in a fun way, you know, it wasn't forced. Yeah, it gave me a glimpse, a tiny glimpse of, you know, what a future family could possibly look like.
Audrey got increasingly comfortable with me. When we sat on the couch watching basketball on TV with her grandpa, she would turn her legs to the side and use me as her ottoman, which Jen said she never does unless she's super comfortable with someone. We hung out as a trio most of the time and became very familiar with one another. It really felt like we were spending time as a family. So you want to hear about how I proposed?
I knew that January 1st was a very significant day for you negatively.
Right.
And I felt like January 1st would be a good day to kind of redeem that day and to propose to you so that it would take on new meaning. And I remember talking to your parents beforehand and telling them my intentions. I was asking them whether they had any concerns about me. I said that, you know, I was still trying to get my footing in my therapy career, and, you know, I didn't have a whole huge bankroll or, you know, all that kind of stuff. And I remember your dad and your mom, they both shook their heads like, no, like none of that matters. The only thing that we want from you is to not have our daughter run back to us, you know? And I said, no, I have no intention of having your daughter run away from me because I am treating her horribly. And I think that the memory of what happened between you and your ex is so, so strong in their mind that that's the thing that they most want to avoid at all costs.
I didn't know that they said that.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, they gave me their blessing. And then that's when I was planning to propose to you. Mm-hmm. And then I chose New Year's. I wanted to kind of go for a walk with you, but nothing is open on New Year's Day, so you can't go. I was thinking of going to like the Irvine Railroad Park because we had gone on one of our early dates there, and I thought maybe with I don't know. There's like train rides. There's a lake. There's all that kind of stuff, but and porcupines. But
there are no porcupines there. There are Shetland ponies.
No, but in the zoo there's a porcupine. Oh. Yeah, and then. So nothing's open. So I thought, okay, well, the only thing that's really open is the park near your house. It's a big park. So I had prepared your fake ring, faux ring, that would be a stand-in so that after you accept my proposal, you can then choose the ring that you really want. Mm-hmm. And then I think I went to Claire's and I got this little
necklace
charm thing that said daughter on it that I was going to give to Audrey as I proposed to you and basically ask her to accept me as stepdad, right? And we went to the park. I said, oh, let's go for a New Year's walk. And I was, you know, planning on guiding the two of you to this gazebo area, and then we were walking, and then right in the middle, you said, I have to go to the bathroom. Like, oh, no. Like, okay. And then I said, well, I mean, there are these public bathrooms, but I know that those gross you out. So I knew that you would want to go back to your house to go to the bathroom. I was like, oh, I better speed this up. So we're walking. You're like, no, I really have to go bathroom. Like, oh, no, no. And then we went. I said, no, but we got to go see the gazebo. We have to go to see the gazebo.
I'm thinking, what's so special about this darn gazebo?
Right, right. And we go to the gazebo. And then, you know, Audrey's, you know, being silly there. And she's like, there's a little
just
stage.
Little
the little dances there. And I could see you getting antsy. I said, okay, it's now or never. So I sit you down. And I think I said, so let's make our New Year's resolutions.
Okay, yeah. You said you wanted to exercise more.
Yeah. And then you were talking about some things. And then it was my turn. I said, I want to exercise more. And I said, and then I want to be a good husband. And then that's when Audrey goes, wait a second. Are you going to propose? And then.
Did she steal your thunder?
Yeah, she did. And I looked over at her like, yes. And then you said, wait, what?
I was not expecting it at all.
Yeah, and then I got on one knee, and then I asked whether you would be my wife. And then Before you had any chance to answer, I think Audrey ran away.
Yeah.
She bolted to like up the hill towards like this tree area.
Yeah.
And so you said,
yes, I will marry you, but hold on.
and I ran after Audrey
because she was, so much in shock and she started crying. And it's only late, much later, that we found out. It wasn't that she didn't want us to get married. It was she didn't want to move out of my parents' house.
Yeah.
Where she had grown up for, her entire life.
And she loves them so much and was so used to that life. So that was quite a memorable proposal. I don't know whether...
Yeah, I mean, I was grateful that you chose... And I think you told me, right? Like, you debated whether to include her in the proposal or not.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was thankful that you allowed her to be present. So it wasn't like, surprise, we're getting married. And, you have really no say or you can't be present to witness that.
So that was how I proposed. And then came the wedding planning. How does one plan for a wedding when you have already had a wedding before? Like, do you do it the same? Do you make it different? How do you do it?
I think because our story was so unconventional, I wanted our wedding to reflect our journey and the important friends and family who played a crucial role in that journey. What I really appreciated about you was the fact that you included Audrey in every step of the way, including the invitation. Like, her name was on the invitation as... normally it's a bride and groom, but we had Roy, Jen, and Audrey on our invitation. And the fact that she was part of the ceremony and, standing in front of all the guests and not just, a flower girl who later sat down, that really touched my heart a lot.
It didn't feel right for me to have us become a family and she's a flower girl. Mm-hmm. Like, it didn't...
Like that would be a bystander.
I don't think that even crossed my mind. Mm-hmm. Yeah, she needed to be a part of the wedding, and mm-hmm. I think the challenge is trying to figure out what that would look like.
Mm-hmm. So we actually wrote not just vows to each other, but like vows to Audrey and what we wanted to promise her as mm-hmm. we became a new family.
I really wanted to communicate to her, I didn't want to... just say that I promise to be a good stepfather to you, that kind of thing. I wanted to let her know that in many ways it's unfair for her to be in this position, right? She had already talked a bit about how there were no kids that she knew of who mm-hmm. whose parents were either divorced or, she didn't know of many blended families. So she already felt kind of like as...
the minority.
Kind of a minority within a minority.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to affirm that for her, that it is unfair for her. She had no part in, what her parents did. But this is what kind of happened to her. And I told her that if she... had like seasons or waves of feeling that unfairness or sadness or just whatever that negative feeling was, I told her that I would fully understand and she wouldn't have to hide that from me. I wouldn't take that personally. I promised her that. I promised that's not something that I would get upset about. In fact, I would even welcome it because that seems to match what any kid in that situation would be feeling like. But I told her that I would do my best, to be, always supportive for her and, to be the best stepfather I could be. I was feeling very emotional on the wedding day as I was making those vows to her.
We had a lot of unconventional aspects. This was not the first wedding for both of us, so we decided not to have a bridal party. We had a small intimate wedding of around 100 people, maybe less, and we had a southern barbecue, which was really fun.
There was no first dance because neither of us likes to dance, especially in public.
Or in private.
Speak for yourself. Our exit and entry was always with Audrey.
I went to one dress place and I bought, it was a off the rack dress, meaning like it was a sample. Others had tried it on and I didn't care.
Was that your mentality when you first got married?
No way. No, I wanted like, you know, yeah. I went to a bridal boutique in downtown Pasadena. It cost a lot.
So why the difference?
Good question. You know, I think my first wedding, it felt like, and this is probably symbolic of the marriage, you know, it felt like a performance or a show. Like I had to do things a certain way because that's how I perceived what it should be in my mind. Like this is the right way to do things. And second time around, like I don't want it to be a show. I want it to be intimate and meaningful and symbolic. You know, like my first wedding, I remember at the time everybody was getting these French manicure tips and I was like, I don't even like that. I want red nails. So that's what I did for our wedding. I had red nails. I think your suit was from like, it's a Ryan Seacrest suit from, I don't know, Macy's or somewhere.
I don't even like Ryan Seacrest. But it was cheap.
And the suit looked nice.
Yeah.
For wedding venues, I didn't even go to the wedding venue. I was at work and Roy took like a 10-minute video to show me the venue. And he told me, I think you'll really like it. And mm-hmm. I did. So we booked it without me having seen it.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I had gotten married 10 years prior. And so just a lot of my priorities changed. Mm-hmm. Who we were as people changed. I think we just matured.
I mean, it was just a really memorable day. Like, you know, all the things that we decided to do on our terms, like that made it all the more special to us. It just seemed tailor-made, you know, for us without any anxieties about, oh, will the people like mm-hmm. this or will they like that? Like, right. We don't really care because we liked it. So
yeah, and I think we were just really present in the moment. And I remember one of my friends told me she saw me during mm-hmm. the ceremony just look around and really just soak in.
I did too. Yeah, I was looking around a lot during the wedding and just kind of locking eyes with right. people that I knew really, really well. It was nice. Like you said earlier, it's these are the people who were pretty key in our like healing journey. And so just to be able to meet eyes with them during the ceremony was very, very significant.
It's been 2 years since our wedding. And I've learned that the heart is a mysterious thing. It can be consumed and filled with one person and then crushed when that love is destroyed. The heart can feel like it can never love again, or that it can never be loved again. And then the heart can learn to love again, like I love Jen. And the heart can expand and love Audrey with equal strength. The heart can heal. You know, in the middle of editing this podcast, one night, I dreamt of bumping into my ex-wife and her affair partner. In my dream, I reached out to extend a handshake to the man. And I also shook the hand of my ex-wife. Her hands were cold and clammy, as if she were deathly afraid of this moment, or maybe of me. I felt pity for her as they walked away. And in my heart, I wished them well. And this was in stark contrast to when I was deep in my trauma and I wished nothing but violence and agony upon them. My heart didn't heal because it had some special Wolverine-like powers. My heart, and I believe Jen's heart, healed sometimes despite our aggression against God, and sometimes because we intentionally put ourselves in healing environments, such as therapy and being with key safe people. And I believe your heart can heal too. here are some last thoughts before we close.
You know, I realize my story is uniquely my own, and I was trying so hard to fit in to be like everyone else when the very story that brought me so much pain is also the reason why I am who I am today. Mm-hmm. And so looking back, I would not trade all of the pain and all of those tears for anything. You know, I like myself so much better today. Mm-hmm. I think having suffered really allowed me to be more empathetic. It makes me more approachable.
Yeah.
When I tell somebody, you know, I was a single mom for 7 years.
You were?
Or I was divorced, you know. I think it breaks down barriers and puts down somebody's guard, I think.
Yeah, I bet you experience a lot of people telling a bit of their story after you share it first, right?
Right. It opens up that that dialogue.
This episode wouldn't feel complete without sharing some vivid memories about friendship. Where would we be without true friendship? Friends who made us feel safe, who made us feel like we weren't alone.
I'll share maybe just two stories. So when I had left my home that we shared when we were married, you know, because I had fled so abruptly, all my stuff was still there and my ex had moved out. So the house had all the furniture, all of the kitchen stuff in the fridge. It looked as if it was kind of frozen in time, but it was a hot mess. And I remember I had to pack up my things because, you know, our house sold and we needed to vacate it. It was painful packing up a life and all of my dreams. My friend Michelle, she went with me to help me pack up everything. And, you know, she helped me wrap up my kitchen bowls. She helped me pack even some of his stuff that he had left behind haphazardly. And I remember just like trying so hard not to cry. And I'll always remember as she was packing up my stuff, she told me, "Jen, I truly believe that one day you're going to open up all of this kitchen stuff again and you're going to use it in your new home again." And I remember at that time, I was thinking, are you kidding me? Like, my life is over. Everything is shattered. I'm never going to have my own home. I'm going to move back to my parents' house at age 29 and I have no use for any of this anymore. And so it was extra meaningful when I was unpacking all of that in our new home. I remember those words of her packing up my life with me and just giving me hope that no, like, God's going to redeem your story and you will have use. And she wasn't the only one. My friend Stephanie told me the same thing. Mm-hmm. That's one example.
Well, it helps to have someone have hope for you.
Exactly, when I had no hope.
Yeah.
And they said it not as a way to just
to minimize what you're going through.
Right, mm-hmm. But it was just they truly believed that my story would be redeemed, no matter how long it took.
Yeah.
My other friend, Kristen, really helped me as a single mom. I didn't have hardly any friends who were single moms. The first night that Audrey spent overnight with her dad, I think she was only a little over a year, and I was just a wreck. I was just worried about so many things and wondering how he would care for her properly.
Yeah.
Because she also went through the same thing when her kids went with their dad. So she invited me over for dinner one night at her house and said, "Jen, why don't you come over? We're going to watch a movie. We're going to take your mind off of this and we're just going to hang out together." And I remember, like, before we started, she prayed for me. Yeah, it was really meaningful for friends to be present, not just when you're happy, but especially during those really, really dark moments.
I mean, inviting you over is such a tangible expression of care for you. Mm-hmm. This doesn't discount people who just, you know, randomly text you and say, "How are you doing?"
Right.
Like, those are all good as well. But to invite you over and to just show you that level of care, like, that's very special.
And on that specific night where she knew I would be feeling lonely without Audrey and just worrying,
where would you be if you didn't have friends like that?
Still in my very dark valley, you know. These are just two examples, but I just had so many friends, you know, in addition to my own family and my sister, who just really loved on me.
You know, I didn't share this on my first, on the episode one, but when my divorce finalized, yeah, my friend Ghani and I were living together at the time, and we kind of circled that date, that when that date comes, we're going to go to the beach over where LAX is and kind of watch the planes fly by over us. I think it's Dockweiler State Beach. And we prepared like logs to
Duraflames.
Well, no, these are actual logs that we try to like saw through. Like I had remnants of things that were mementos, really, from my days being married to my ex. We went out there, and it was at nighttime, and we lit the bonfire. You know, I had a pile of this stuff that I was going to burn, and I burned each one. I threw each one individually, and I, like, intentionally told Ghani what that thing meant to me, right? Like, what the memory was, why it was so significant, and basically how much it hurt to, you know, basically say goodbye to that. And I remember it was just so emotional. And then when it was all done, I was just kind of like staring at the fire and looking at it all burn in front of me. And I remember Ghani like coming to me and just putting his arms around me and just embracing me. And it was such a heartfelt moment of like pain, but also like tenderness from him. And it was kind of closure for me. And you know friends like him, they are invaluable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's hard enough to go through this in life, but when you have friends like that who can go show those acts of care, I think that's kind of what life is all about. Like, you have to go through the ups and downs with people, because if not, then I think you're kind of screwed, you know? So things like that stand out. And there are other stories that I can tell, but that's just a very vivid example that I can come up with.
I like that imagery of the fire, because I feel like it's super symbolic of God making beauty from ashes.
Nearly everyone has that story of brokenness, and if they don't yet, then I think
they
it's coming.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, like, I think we try so hard to keep that hidden. Many of us do, but I just feel like our communities get stronger,
mm-hmm.
our relationships get stronger when we actually do share those stories of brokenness instead of hiding them, because it does make one another approachable. I think it levels the playing field, and it just invites more mm-hmm. heart-to-heart connection.
Right.
So mm-hmm. thanks for being on the show.
Thank you.
I'll see you in 5 minutes.
Well, friends, it's been my honor being your captain and host. This is not the end of the same boat. It's merely the end of season one. A transfer point, if you will. I hope there was something in this episode or any episode prior that helped you feel you're not alone, that there are others in the same boat as you. Thank you for listening, and please disembark safely.
Okay, so Audrey, you have some jokes for me?
Yep. Number one, which duck is a great basketball player?
Kevin Duckworth.
Donald Dunk.
Oh, dear.
Okay. How do you cut the ocean in half?
With a seesaw.
Correct.
Yeah. Yes. Okay.
Why does Dewey jump up and down before he takes his medicine?
Why?
Because the label says, shake before using.
Oh, dear. I
bonus one.
Okay, bonus.
Why did the vampires lose the baseball game?
Mommy says because they sucked.
Do you want to know the answer?
Yeah.
Their bats flew away.
And they sucked. And they sucked. Thanks, Audrey.
Today's song credits go to Nathan Baldwin, who created and produced original theme music. Follow Nathan on Instagram at TheNathanBaldwin. Also Ben Bonkan at freesound.org for Four Bells Ship Time. Beauty Flow, Clear Waters, 80s Action, Easy Lemon, Martini Sunset by Kevin MacLeod on incompetech.com. License under Creative Commons by Attribution 4.0 license. Balance by Komiku. Favorite by Alexander Nakarada. Hip Hop Interrupt by Frank Nora. The Vinyl Bounce by Alistair Fernandez. River Meditation and Allison by Jason Shaw. The podcast logo was designed by Hayun Chong. You can follow her on Instagram at hye.yoon. This podcast is not meant to be taken as professional counseling advice, nor is it meant to be a substitute for professional therapy or pastoral counsel.
Bonus. Okay.
Last one.
Okay.
What did the mom airplane say to the kid airplane?
You are a plain old son.
Nope. You're grounded.
Oh, dear. You know you're being recorded.